So let us switch to Guy Metcalfe's presentation. So Guy is a specialist, also, as all of my speakers today, a specialist on climate economics, and he's from Tufts University. So Guy, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Christiane, and thank you for organizing this event today. So I'm moving away from a social optimizing approach and moving away towards it from a temperature type goal to thinking about the macro implications of a more short-term target. In particular, President Biden in 2021 put forward a new updated national NDC. Commitment to reducing emissions, aiming at 50 to 52% reduction from 2005 levels in 2030. And so what my colleague, Alan Finkelstein and Shapiro and I wanted to do is think about what are the macroeconomic costs of hitting that that kind of target. And just to be clear, we're looking at a target reduction that's focused on a reduction from 2005 levels. So that would mean reducing emissions in the United States to about 3 gigatons. And but of course, we've had emission reductions between 2005 and today. So 2020, this is historic. Projections from the Energy Information Administration Annual Energy Outlook. And so we're really looking at a reduction on the order of 35% as opposed to 50%. And so that's what we're going to be modeling in the paper. So the idea is that what is the cost and what do we know from the literature? Well, there's been some empirical work done, Yamazaki looking at British Columbia with other co-authors. And what we typically find is that there's little impact on aggregate employment, which will be the focus of our work here today. And that's corroborated by work that Jim Stock and I have done looking at carbon taxes in Europe for the 15 countries with carbon taxes, where there's great variation on when those taxes were put into place as well as when they were, as well as their levels. And using a local projections approach, we basically find that there's zero impact of these taxes on either GDP growth or on employment. This is a picture actually for the impact of a $40 per ton carbon tax increase that covers 35% of emissions, which is about the average of carbon tax coverage in the EU countries with carbon taxes. There's essentially no impact that we can discern on either GDP or employment. And so that's basically, the empirical work doesn't find much of an impact, if any, on aggregate employment. Of course, there is significant changes in sectoral employment. We see big shifts away from dirty industries towards employment in green industries, as you would expect, as we would hope, but not in the aggregate level of employment. And if we look at general equilibrium models, we see, first off, if we look at sort of the older kinds of models that have been used to look at the question, they really can't tell us anything about aggregate employment because the models assume full employment. They can tell us something about sectoral shifts, but not much more than that. But there has been work that has incorporated frictional unemployment, work by Mark Hafstead and Rob Williams and Garth Hutel and various co-authors. And these papers have sort of brought us closer to sort of realism in terms of thinking about unemployment in a macro context. And that's what we'll be doing in our paper here. And there, with these models, you actually do find adverse impacts both on GDP, as well as consumption, as well as unemployment. So what we wanted to do in thinking about the problem in this paper is to add some additional dimensions for thinking about what's going on in the economy that might affect employment. And of course, in thinking about that, we have to think about the different ways that we can reduce emissions. Well, one is we can change consumption. We can change what we choose to consume away from say, carbon-intensive vehicles to electric vehicles. We can also engage in various ways to abate our emissions. And we can also change our production technologies. Amazon is moving towards a fleet of electric vehicles. And we can also take into account the fact that we may have new firms entering the market that may be using new technologies. And these were the kinds of impacts that we wanted to try to capture within this model. So we focus on these three interacting dimensions that we have environmental policy affecting employment, but we have environmental policy that affects firm creation, and I listed a few papers there, and then environmental policy and technology adoption. And so these are the features we want to capture, as well as pollution. So we're doing this in a structure of a model where we have firms that are entering and incurring a sunk cost of entry. And upon entry, they draw a random productivity level based on some distribution. And that productivity draw then leads firms to their choice of what their a particular product variety is going to be. Are they going to produce a Chevrolet Bolt, or are they going to produce a Chevrolet Malibu, or a Hummer, or a Tesla within the automobile context? And then they can choose a technology for production, whether it's a regular technology or a green carbon-free technology. And the green technology entails zero emissions, but there is a fixed cost of adopting this type of technology. And then firms hire capital and labor, and if they're a regular firm, they will generate pollution. So the structure of the model is one where we have capital and labor that are being employed in technologies, the choice whether you're going to use a regular technology that creates emissions or a green technology that doesn't, and then we have final goods that are being produced in a product variety model that is I think of it as a Dixit-Stiglitz product differentiation model. Rather than having automobiles, we have different types of automobiles. So with product variety, this allows for firms to be earning monopolistic rents on the fact that my corn flakes are different than corn checks, which are different from rice checks, if you will, or a Chevy Bolt is different than a Chevy Malibu, which is different than a Tesla. Y is aggregate output in the economy, which is this summing up over the product variation. We have a overall price index for the economy. The overall price index, and firms are simultaneously choosing to enter to select their technology and determine the level of output, and they are earning profits that are equal to the real price that they're earning less the cost of production times the amount of the good that they're producing, which is going to be indexed by the productivity level of the firm A, which will have some distribution. And the marginal cost of production simply follows from a simple model where we have different levels of productivity of labor, which then leads to marginal cost, which is basically the wage times output levels divided by this productivity factor here. And we have green firms, we have regular firms and green firms, the only difference really being that the green firms have this fixed cost of adopting the green technology. So in the typical Dixit-Stiglitz or Gironi-Melitz model, each firm has a little bit of a monopoly power, so that there's an individual demand that they're facing, and they have a price markup condition, so the real price is marked up over the marginal cost of production. And firms are then choosing to maximize their profits, knowing what the demand for their product is. Let me skip through the math and get to the results of the model. The first result is that the firms will choose their level, their type of technology, whether it's a green technology or a regular technology, based on their level of productivity. And there is a threshold level of productivity where the profits are equal for the two types of technology. So the more productive firms will choose the green technology, the less productive firms will choose the regular technology. And this is this follows from the fact that there is this fixed cost of choosing the green technology. So you need the higher productivity, and that just is reflected in this graph here, showing that as we look across the space of the values of productivity, we see that we have profit lines, profit functions for the two types of firms, and there is this threshold level where it makes sense to. Beyond which it makes sense to choose to be a green firm. So let me skip the conditional expectations. This is just some terminology in the paper. Basically, we don't need to spend any time on here. The number of firms are going to be equal to the existing number of firms from the previous period plus new entrants, but there is some exogenous firm exit delta. And based on the distribution function for productivity, some fraction of those overall firms will be regular technologies, and some fraction of those firms will be green technologies. And this is the average productivity within the red firms and average productivity of green firms. And so average profits for firms is some weighted average of the profits conditional on being in each sector. And of course, this will, the average, the expected profits, of course, determines whether someone wants to create a new firm or not. If the expected profits are not positive, then they won't enter. If they are positive, they will enter, but then they will end up being either a regular firm or a green firm. A lot of math. I should have moved more towards words, but I apologize for that. But basically, you can think of the choice of firms as to the mix of labor and capital to choose. We can use a construct, a sort of an artificial construct, to decompose production and technology adoption. But with the idea that the firm producing the final good is purchasing an intermediate input that's either a regular or a green technology input. And the reason for this is just to facilitate comparison to models that abstract from firm entry and technology adoption. But the idea is that there is some level of output that is being produced, and some of it is going to be damaged by climate change. And our climate change, we have a damage function, which is a function of the stock of emissions, which is some of it is decomposing over time with the rate rho sub x, but we have new emissions in every period. So we lose some of our output, sort of a standard sort of Nordhaus type approach. The only difference here is that our abatement cost, which is going to be a function here of the net output, which is a little different than what's in the Dice model, where abatement and emissions are functions of gross output. We've actually done this both ways, and it really doesn't affect the outcome, the results that I'll show you in a moment. The reason we modeled this way is because there are several other papers that have looked at the macroeconomic impacts of climate change, including some work by Garth Utell that used this formulation, and we just wanted to be consistent with what Garth and others have done. So we have the output from intermediate goods. We have some wages that are being paid to workers. We also have some job posting costs for hiring workers. We then have some carbon tax on emissions, and we have the cost of abatement that are being incurred by the regular firms. And so the difference between the regular and the green technology is that there's no carbon tax, since there's no emissions from the green technology, and there's no abatement activities taking place by the green technology as well. We have a search model for employment, so we have some job filling probabilities that affects the number of workers coming into each of the sectors. Let me skip over that. Households are maximizing utility, less the disutility cost of being in the labor force. And they have a budget constraint where their consumption plus the cost of setting up new firms plus any lump sum tax they have to pay they have wage income. They also have some unemployment benefits for those who are looking for work and have not been able to find work yet. And then, of course, there are any profits to be distributed to the households, as well as the distribution from any carbon tax we put in place. Our employment and labor force participation is sort of a standard a frictional labor search. So let me not focus much on that. We have an equilibrium process where we have market clearing in the intermediate goods and a matching process to determine wage and hiring rates. We'll normalize the aggregate output price to be equal to one to pin down prices in the general equilibrium model. And we have a resource constraint. So let me focus on the results in the simulation, which will be, I think, perhaps more interesting. So what we're going to do is we're going to reduce long-run emissions by 35% and gradually implement this over 20 quarters. And then what we will do is we'll turn off certain features of the model. First, we'll turn off the feature of firms being able to enter, new firms being able to enter. And then we can also turn off the technology adoption feature, which then leaves us with a model that is more similar to some of the earlier models in the literature calculating our carbon tax rates needed for particular emission reductions. We have model parameters. I'm not going to spend any time on that. Let me turn immediately to the results. So the first column tells you various benchmark model values before we put our carbon tax into place. The second column is then the benchmark values after the tax, and the third column tells you the percentage change for these variables. And down below, since these are all percentages, these are the percentage point changes relative to the baseline. And Alan is in the midst of sort of recalibrating our model, so we actually can give you emissions in real units of megatons or tons. But currently, the current version I'm showing you here, we just normalize emissions to be equal to one in the baseline, and of course, the model is designed to give us a 35% reduction in emissions in the new long-run equilibrium. So that's what we see there. And so what you see is that output is actually going up very modestly, 0.3%. Consumption is also going up very, very modestly. You see significant shifts in employment between the red and the green, regular and the green sectors. And total employment is slightly higher, though it looks lower, doesn't it? Slightly higher. We also calculated the welfare impacts of this, which is not reported here. But the welfare impact is a reduction of about 0.02% of steady state consumption in the benchmark. So essentially, there's no effect on welfare from this change. If we use 2020 as a baseline, we can look at the tax revenue as a fraction of GDP, which is about 0.2%. This is much lower than the U.S. Treasury study from 2016, which estimated revenue on the order of 0.8 to 0.9% of GDP. So if I take 2020 GDP, 0.2%, this translates into about $40 billion annually. and a tax rate of $15 per metric ton. So the first message coming out of this study is that allowing for firm entry and technology adoption lowers the required carbon tax needed to hit the 35% emission reduction, which is a 50% emission reduction from 2005 to achieve the Biden administration nationally determined contribution goal. But now we can sort of unpack results a bit by turning off certain features of the model. And the first feature we turn off is firm entry. And when you do that, we still have the 35% reduction in emissions by design. But now we're seeing that we have a slightly larger increase in output and much bigger swings in employment, much larger reductions in employment in the regular sector and gains in employment in the green sector. And we have a slightly larger increase in overall employment. We also, calculating the welfare, if we turn off firm entry, we now have actually a slight gain of in welfare on the order of about 0.5% of steady state consumption, and we also see that the tax rate goes up. You see that the tax revenue to output is now almost 0.4 of 0.4, and we're now seeing that the carbon tax goes up to, I should have said before in the baseline it was a $15 carbon tax. I think I gave you the wrong number in our benchmark model in the first column. A $15 carbon tax would uniformly in the economy would help hit the 35% reduction target. But now we would need a tax of roughly double that of $31 per ton to get the required emission reductions. And then if we now turn off technology adoption and firm entry, we now see both total output and consumption falling. We still have significant shifts in employment away from the regular technology towards the green technology. And we're seeing the unemployment rate going up more than in the benchmark model or in the model with no firm entry. And now the welfare cost is now on the order of 0.75% of 1% of steady state consumption. So the cost is highest once we've turned off the ability of firms to enter as well as the ability to adopt new technology with a cost. And we also find that now, if we look at the revenue, we're finding that we're getting results that are now much closer to, say, what the Treasury study was. The Treasury study was actually only cutting emissions by 20%. And if we recalibrate our model to a 20% emission reduction, then we find a required tax rate of $61 per ton is needed to get that 20% reduction. So that is actually quite close to what was found in the Treasury study and in some other studies that have looked at similar kinds of reductions. But for the 35% reduction that we're modeling here, now we would need a tax rate of about $134 per metric ton once we turn off these other features. So what we take away from this is that modeling technology adoption and firm entry are really critical for determining what carbon price would be needed to achieve any given emission reduction. And I think this sort of accords with what Rick was finding in showing us in his previous paper, though with different optimization framework in mind. Looking at the transitional dynamics as we move towards that new steady state, you see that there are real differences between our benchmark model, which includes firm entry as well as technology adoption in the models where we turn off fermentary, the green, or the model where we turn off both entry as well as technology adoption, we see that that there's real differences, say, in consumption and output over along the transition path, as well as in the new steady state equilibrium. The unemployment rate is much higher if we turn off these different features of the model, fermentary and technology adoption. And I'll just note that you have much higher tax revenues required, and so the revenue to GDP ratio is much higher without the features of fermentary and technology adoption. We can also look at the labor market, and we see some big differences in employment in the sectors in terms of the shifts between the sectors, as well as wage rates, growth in wage rates. And finally, looking at emissions, of course, the emissions has to get us to the same place because we have to get that 35% reduction, but the carbon tax rate needed in order to do that is looking very different across those three models. So to conclude, this is a static model in the sense that we're really showing you two equilibria, one before and one after the tax, that we have some transitional dynamics in there, but a model with equilibrium unemployment, fermentary and exit, and endogenous technology adoption. And I think the key points are that we get some positive impacts from this more realistic market structure, including the impacts on GDP and employment, as well as what level of carbon tax would be required to achieve a given emission reductions. And so I guess the final conclusion just then is that there's really a very modest cost to the United States were we to implement a policy to achieve the Biden administration's goal of reducing emissions by 50 or 52% relative to 2005. And so with that, I will end. Thank you very much.